Coming up on Weekend America.
Naval Petty Officer Leonard Neely never thought he'd have to go to Iraq.
They told me Thanksgiving of 2006, going to Iraq for a year, and I just had my son. He was barely 6 months old, so that's not something you really want to hear.
We'll join Petty Officer Neely on his first weekend home. I'm Desiree Cooper.
And I'm Bill Radke. When Sonia Lubomirsky first came to Los Angeles, she was so happy.
Every day I would say that to myself. Oh, look, it's so sunny outside. And the sky is incredibly blue. And then after a while, you get used to it.
Now she wants to know, how do people stay happy? And Usman C. wants to turn your spring cleaning into philanthropy.
I know, have or have not, what that means. And I knew it from day one. I can make a lot of people smile, a lot of people proud.
Use paint from your garage to an African orphanage. After the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, welcome to The Weekend. I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles.
And in St. Paul, I'm Desiree Cooper. Spring is when Mother Nature gets really creative. Blooming flowers, zany weather, and the ultimate act of creation, baby animals are everywhere. But it also brings out the creative spirit in people. This hour, we'll go to Los Angeles, where hundreds are trying to write a novel together. And we'll talk to a prize-winning poet who will reveal his writing process. Hint, it's hard work. How about you? What makes a good work ethic?
Being reliable and dependable.
Loyalty and honesty.
I think having pride in your work.
Don't try to please everybody. Just do your best and please yourself.
I surround myself with good people. So once that's set up, everything else is kind of nice and easy and I can just focus.
The best thing for a good work ethic is to actually have some motivation to guide you. I mean, when one has nothing pushing them forward, motivation and work ethic cease.
Some people can learn it, but it's always there. It just needs to be brought to the forefront of their mind. But it really boils down to either you have it or you don't.
No, don't say that. Can I buy it online or something?
I think you can get it on eBay. Those voices came from Lincoln, Nebraska, Washington, D.C., and Concord, New Hampshire.
Thanks for tuning in to Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke, and we're going to begin this hour by looking at the American weekend through the eyes of people who haven't seen it in a long time. Our series is called First Weekend Home. Today, reporter Nate DeMeo introduces us to Leonard Neely. Neely is one of a growing number of naval personnel joining the fight in Iraq. Nate caught up with the sailor at his mom's house in Los Angeles.
On the couch in his mother's house.
Nate, this is my son, Leonard.
And how you doing?
Squarely in the landing path of Los Angeles International Airport, Navy Petty Officer Leonard Neely told me how he lost 14 months of his life. He'd gotten back from Iraq a week before and flew down here from his house outside of Seattle to see his family. His brother suggested a trip to Disneyland.
And I figured, you know, it'd be a good place to take, you know, my son. Even though I knew he was going to be young and not really realize who Mickey Mouse was or who anything was like that, but it'd still be good to have some pictures.
Neely didn't expect to have to lose a year. That's part of why he joined the Navy instead of another service, to stay away from places like Iraq.
Being in the Navy, you know, you expect to go on the water, go on your shore duty, and that's it.
Neely joined up after graduating high school 7 years ago. Now, the first six of those went according to expectations. He was on a boat for four and then got stationed on a base, all far from harm's way. The American Navy, excluding the bombing of the USS Cole in 2000, is usually parked somewhere offshore, out of the line of fire. When there's a war on, that's the kind of thing that gives a man and his mother and the mother of his own baby comfort.
They told me Thanksgiving of 2006, going to Iraq for a year, and I just had my son. He was barely 6 months old, so that's not something you really want to hear.
In January of 2007, his girlfriend was unpacking boxes in a new and suddenly emptier apartment that the couple and their baby had just moved into. Neely was on his first ever 22-hour flight, sweating under 70 pounds of gear.
Before you even actually get to Iraq, you're just already hating life, pretty much. And, you know, you get there, basically they send you to the room. The next day, you're out there doing what you're supposed to do.
For Neely, that meant doing what he'd done at sea. He made sure a massive anti-rocket machine gun was ready to fire at incoming missiles or mortars. Now he had to do it in the sand, as one of a dozen sailors in a sea of soldiers at Camp Anaconda. The Army base had earned the nickname Mortaritaville. Three or four times a day,
incoming,
a voice over a loudspeaker would send him to the floor.
All hands take cover. You're thinking, you hope it doesn't land on you. You're also hoping that the guns work.
Because if the guns don't work, not only could people die, but Neely could face a double or a triple or even a quadruple shift getting them back up. But those were the exception.
Working hours wasn't long for us. You know, it was only 4 days a week. Base had a movie theater, a Burger King, Taco Bell, the PX.
But it got old. And soon Neely's Iraq war experience slipped into monotony. Get up, go to work, eat, work out, play Xbox, go to bed, repeat. Even the mortars got sort of boring. The whole time he was there, there was one injury from all of those attacks. After a few months, he barely paid attention to the alarms.
I talked to my roommate all the time. You know, I was like, you know, remember the days when we first got here and we was always diving on the ground and stuff? But, you know, now we're in our room. You know, we might hit our alarm. We might turn the TV down.
Neely never left the base in 14 months. And between the Xbox and the Taco Bell and the high-speed internet access right there in his room, the Iraq war for him started to feel like a strange sort of limbo. It had so much of the stuff of home, but was so not home. He could send an email to his girlfriend, and if she happened to be online, they could chat like normal.
You know, sometimes we'd be online talking or whatnot, and, you know, I'd be like, oh, you know, be right back. I gotta go out to one of the guns or something like that.
And they're trying to maintain a long-distance relationship, and he's emailing about his bizarre life in the desert. And she's emailing about a life he understands all too well. It was like back at home, his own life was going on without him. And in Iraq, he had this other life, where the days bled into each other and everything felt a little off.
I didn't really think about time or anything until I got within like 10 weeks. And then, you know, we started making a little countdown or whatnot, which actually made the time go by slower.
14 months of get up, go to work, eat, work out, play Xbox, go to sleep, maybe duck occasionally, ended for Neely. He flew home to Seattle, this time commercial, and his girlfriend picked him up at the airport. It was great. And it was great to see his son.
When I left, he's like barely crawling. Get back, he's running all over the place, you know, saying words and stuff like that. But the good thing was he still remembered who I was, which was one of the big things I was going to be worried about, you know, if he's going to remember me or if he's going to be shy around me or stuff like that.
And for he and his girlfriend, it was good too. Before he left, he went to these briefings about how difficult the transition back can be on couples. But he says they've fallen right back into a familiar rhythm. They've been going to his favorite restaurants. The first night they went to Applebee's. On Sunday they went to IHOP like they normally do. They tried to go to his all-time favorite restaurant, Red Lobster, but it was closed. He said they'd go as soon as they got back from visiting his family in L.A. He's just happy to be home. He's proud of his service, but happy to put Iraq, the defining conflict of his generation, well behind him.
It's not going to be thought of too much, really. It's just going to be going about my normal daily life or whatever, taking care of my kids and just doing my job. Try not to think about that stuff too much, all right? Because for the most part, it did, you know, suck.
In Los Angeles, I'm Nate DeMeo for Weekend America.
You can hear all of our first weekend home stories at our website and let us know about your own first weekend home tale. We hope you spend some time with us at weekendamerica.org.
This weekend, I'm willing to bet that you or somebody in your family will be headed to the grocery store. Well, get ready for sticker shock. Corn prices are higher than they've been in decades, and that's affecting the price of everything from sodas sweetened with corn syrup to plastic containers made from corn. Cereal prices were up 9% in the 6 months that ended in February. In Ohio, food pantries are reporting record demand for free groceries. The Buckeye State has lost more than 200,000 manufacturing jobs in this past decade, and it's also been hit hard by the foreclosure crisis. We sent Mari Saito from WCPN in Cleveland to the city's food bank to talk to customers there.
Good morning. I thought I was on time for my appointment at the Cleveland Food Bank with Ann Shotwell. She comes to the huge warehouse a couple times a week to stock up for the hot meals she cooks at Cleveland's Morningstar Baptist Church. But after nearly three decades in the business, Ms. Shotwell, as everyone here calls her, knows it pays to be early. By the time I walk into the bright, clean market, she's already scored her best deal, 15 pounds of Dunkin' Donuts coffee.
So we don't get coffee too often because it costs too much money, but they had coffee here today, and I rated that for this, and at 14 cents a pound, we can have coffee for a while.
Ms. Shotwell gets $250 from the county to feed 150 people a hot, multi-course meal three times a month. She even serves seconds. It's a job this grandmother gets done with free and low-cost food from the Cleveland Food Bank.
No hot dogs, no hamburgers. We always have two meats, potatoes, spaghetti, green beans, corn. We feed a balanced meal.
The number of hungry people getting food from hot meal centers like Ms. Shotwell's is climbing fast. Last year, local agencies in the surrounding area served a million more people than in 2006. Clevelanders opened 57 new hunger programs last year. Many of them are in the suburbs.
At one time, youngsters appeared to be ashamed to come and stand in line to eat, but now they open the door. And that's because they just don't have it at home now. They used to would make out with whatever bit was at home. But now I have teenagers, I have early 20s, and that's something that's new.
Ms. Shotwell says she's heard lots of reasons why more people are coming in. Some diners say higher food and gas prices. Others say there's not enough good jobs and folks are losing their homes in foreclosure. The thing is, at the same time demand is increasing, food donations are dropping.
We used to get things that may have been mislabeled or are getting near their expiration date. A lot of times now, retailers are selling that product to discount stores.
That's Karen Posna. She works for the Cleveland Food Bank and says they have to buy food to make up for the drop in donations. But food is getting too expensive.
We don't buy cheese right now just because it's not the best buy for us.
See, you never know what they're going to drop off in here. See, they just dropped here. I need that ham.
Yes, ma'am.
Ms. Shotwell smiles as a clerk puts a large ham on her cart. With the growing number of people coming in, Ms. Shotwell likes to keep turkey and ham in the freezer and peanut butter and jelly in the cupboards for emergency sandwiches.
We have hungry people. We don't have that group of people that's eating because you got a free meal somewhere. I have people that need the food.
This week, Ms. Shotwell's serving Italian sausage and potatoes. She's now looking for her sides. Before she leaves, she tells people here that over the weekend, they better be on the lookout for green beans for her diners. For Weekend America, I'm Mari Saito in Cleveland.
Phil, what's in this box right here, hon, that says Southern Star, Northern Star? What is it, Phil?
Eggs out.
Oh, I don't want the egg salad. I think I want potato salad. I think you got some right there. Now, Phil.
Don't expect food prices to drop anytime soon. The USDA predicts that food costs are going to rise as much as 4.5% this year. Some of the leading big-ticket items, eggs, dairy, and poultry. There are photos of Ann Shotwell and the Cleveland Food Bank. Meet them all at our website, weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week.
Coming up, we want our children to be happy. What can we actually do about it? That's next on Weekend America. This is Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. Last year, I became a first-time parent. And on this show, I've been doing a monthly series about the values I hope to pass on to my daughter. This week, Susanna is turning 14 months old. As I do these stories, I notice that I often will agonize about my own childhood as I think about these issues. And I'll dwell on my regrets and my frustrations and my fears for my daughter's future. This is what a psychologist would call rumination.
It's examining your life too much. It's pondering and introspecting and dissecting every little thing about yourself, especially negative things.
Sonia Lubomirsky is a research psychologist and professor. She's written a book called The How of Happiness, A Scientific Approach to Getting the Life You Want. I went to her apartment in Santa Monica and asked her how I can help my daughter be happy over the course of her life. And she talked about rumination. In Susanna's life, when things go badly, if she's anything like me, she's going to focus on that misfortune, try to figure out what went wrong, why life is so hard, and who's to blame. This is human, it's very common, and it's a terrible idea.
But what happens is when you're angry or anxious or sad, you're very biased in your thinking. And so it's really not serving a purpose. And examine life is important, but it has to be done when you're in a neutral or positive mood.
In order to be more happy, would you be willing to be more shallow?
Well, I think that's a myth. There's this famous scene in Annie Hall where Woody Allen is walking down the street and he sees this couple and they're dressed in tennis whites and they look really happy and he comes up to them and says something like, you know, you look very happy, like a very happy couple. How do you do it? And they say, oh, that's because, you know, we're shallow and we have no ideas and nothing interesting to say. And so it's that myth, I think, that pervades our culture that happy people's ignorance is bliss. You know, happy people are shallower. But the research actually shows that happier people are more creative. They're more flexible in their thinking. I do think it's a myth. And because people think that happy people see the world through rose-colored glasses. They don't see the world as it really is. And my response to that is that we don't know what the world really is, that there are multiple perspectives of the world. It's at the same time, the world is a wonderful place. You see lots of compassion and goodness. And at the same time, you see a lot of evil and injustice and oppression. And there's no true way of seeing the world. And so you can't say that happier people are somehow deluded.
So her advice to me and my daughter and you is when you're upset and you start ruminating, stop. Distract yourself. Think about something else. If you really want to wallow, you can wallow later, and you probably won't. Now, there's another value Dr. Lubomirsky advised me to embrace in my family, and for that, we got in the car. We drove about 20 blocks to a park bench overlooking the Pacific Ocean. The sandy beach, palm trees, the Malibu hills in the distance, all under a sunny blue sky. She lives less than a mile from what she calls the most wonderful place in the world.
You know, when I first moved to California, I remember waking up every day thinking, wow, what a beautiful day. And every day I would say that to myself. Oh, look, it's so sunny outside. And the sky is incredibly blue. And then after a while, you get used to it.
Yep. People adapt to stuff. When you break your leg, you're miserable at first, but pretty soon you're used to crutches. On the other hand, when you live near the ocean, pretty soon you take that for granted. This is called hedonic adaptation, and Lubomirsky helps her children avoid this. When a friend from Montreal visited last weekend, she took her kids and this friend here to this oceanside park.
I got her to talk a lot about what the weather was like in Montreal then, to get them to appreciate it. And so she talked about how it's so cold and her two-year-old doesn't want to walk on the snow because it's too cold. But of course, it totally backfired because my kids just started saying, oh, we want to go in snow. We want snow. So it didn't work.
There's been a ton of books lately about happiness and how our brains make sense of the world. I've been reading about them in a Washington Post column called The Human Behavior Department. It's written by Shankar Vedantham. I wanted to know what wisdom Vedantham has gained from reviewing all of this research. What has he learned that I can pass on to my daughter? And he told me that his greatest lesson has come not from the psychologists, but from his own two-year-old daughter.
A few weeks ago, a family friend of ours came over and they brought my daughter a little gift, a little bath toy. It was this blue toy octopus with a little button, and if you press the button while the octopus is in the bath, the octopus would spurt water. And at the moment I saw it, I was immediately thinking forward to, you know, how enjoyable it would be to put the little toy in the bath and have it spurt, and I wanted to sort of get to that moment right away. My daughter, as most parents of children will know, was as much interested in the box as in the toy itself, and we had this a little bit of a tugging match with her trying to tell me that she really wanted to explore the box and play with it, and that was as interesting to her as the final product, as I was trying to tell her, no, forget the box. It's completely unimportant. It's only the, you know, the way station on the way to what's actually important, which is to play with the toy in the bath.
So you know where this is going, right? The lesson is that we should live in the present, that life's meaning resides not in the future, but in this moment of delight. That's what Vedantham teaches his daughter, right?
Well, I'm going to sound very contradictory and hypocritical, because I think much of what I'm training my daughter to do is to think about the future and is to foresee the consequences of her actions, to try and recognize that when she, you know, jumps off the steps, she could get hurt. And when she does this, it's going to have this consequence. And, you know, if she asks for something politely, it's likely to, you know, produce a favorable response from her, from my wife or from myself. So in much of my everyday life, I'm training my daughter to do exactly the opposite of what I'm telling you is important to do. You know, being able to live in the future is a very, very valuable skill. It also comes at a price, and a price that's, I think, often hidden from us, which is that it takes us away from the moment, away from the present. I will say, in my defense, that I try very much to try and learn from my daughter, and I try when I'm with her to enjoy myself and to be with her and not try and do six things at the same time and be distracted when I'm with her. You know, one of the fallacies, if you will, in the original question you posed, and this is my two cents, is that I'm not sure it's the things you actually convey through your words that impart the most valuable lessons to your children. When I think about the lessons that I've picked up from my parents, I mean, they've told me a zillion things that, you know, I no longer follow. But when I look at my own life and my own attitudes toward work and towards family, I have integrated a great deal from my parents, but these were often the things that were never discussed at all. They were never made explicit. And I think in communicating, in sort of the idea of what can you communicate to your child, I think it's important to try and acknowledge the idea that most of the important things you communicate are not going to be communicated through your words, but through your actions.
Now that I think about it, I'm sure he's right. My daughter already imitates my actions. The other day, she grabbed my finger and put it into her mouth. I had no idea why. Then I realized I'd been biting my fingernail, and she wanted to do it too. I wonder what other actions of mine she'll notice. I mean, I play with her a lot and I read to her, but my wife and I also both work, so Susanna spends almost as much time with her nanny as with us. What's she going to conclude from that action? What kind of parent am I? And what about all my faults and my bad habits that I can't seem to control? She's going to pick up on all of those. Okay, I think I'm ruminating. I'm stopping now. This is Weekend America.
Weekend America is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, KPCC Los Angeles, and KUOW Seattle, and is made possible in part by the University of Washington Executive MBA Program.
Maybe you don't want to spend your weekend spring cleaning, but what if you were brightening an African village at the same time? How to really paint the town, coming up on Weekend America.
From American Public Media, thanks for sharing your weekend with us. I'm Desiree Cooper.
And I'm Bill Radke. It's time for your letters now. Last week, we introduced you to Kim Hirschberger. She told us the soundtrack to her weekend is Phil Collins' Against All Odds. Kim is a surviving twin. Her twin sister died in a car accident. And Kim told me she wished she could meet other surviving twins. That prompted a lot of people to write into us, some twins and some not.
Dr. Isabel Phillips heard us on Boston's WBUR, and she wrote, I lost my younger brother to suicide, and I have an older sister who has schizophrenia. I feel like I'm living my own successful life with such indescribable dimensions of aching loss. Sometimes the feelings of despair and isolation are so enraging, but other times I'm inspired to live on because a story like yours emerges, like a beloved companion to light my way.
Thank you for that, Isabel. We will pass on all of your letters of support to Kim Hirschberger.
Last week, we also brought you a story from John Moe. He talked about what moving has meant for his emotional baggage, including an 80-pound box filled with reminders of his past. Nicole Rabeau listens to us on WUNC in Durham, North Carolina. Her dad died 6 years ago, and she has two of his boxes left. They concern the divorce between her mom and dad. She says John's story was a call to action for her. Nicole, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Desiree.
So, Nicole, what kinds of things were in the boxes?
It's kind of a crazy mix. There's, you know, blueprints for renovations that my parents were undertaking. There were love notes post-divorce. There were affidavits from my dad's family that he had everyone sign saying how my mom was, you know, unfit. There's old grade reports and drawings and photos because there was a file. They fought heavily over me. And so that everything I did, I guess, got scrutinized. And it's odd because my recollection was I felt very invisible during that time. So that was interesting. And I'm sort of bracing myself because there's other things that I don't know if I'm going to encounter. I seem to remember that I went through a psychological examination. And I think there was a accusation of incest that was part of it. So I don't know if I'm going to run into that. And then I don't know if I'm what I'm going to do at that point because maybe I don't want to read it, or maybe I do want to read it, and it'll be a relief. I don't know.
Has anything surprised you in the box?
I keep finding little dried violets in there, little dried flowers. I don't know what they mean. I don't know if they were from something sentimental. Certainly, I think that the love notes post-divorce are sort of an interesting thing to ponder. Clearly, they were in love still in some way. So that's a surprise. And then, you know, to play it out in my mind, well, how would that be? I wonder if to a certain extent they were flirting with each other, but then inevitably would feel the rejection afresh, and that's why I always saw this constant burning anger.
Mm-hmm. How long do you think it will take you to get to the bottom of the boxes?
Well, I think I have the stomach for another week or two, but I have to take breaks. There are times when I feel like my stomach gets all knotted up.
What's that knot in your stomach?
I get tense when I read certain documents, and it rekindles feelings I didn't want to have again, or it turns on its head something that I didn't think about my dad. I didn't think of him in this way.
Can you give me an example of something you've come across that turned your idea of your father topsy-turvy?
I think that affidavit that he had everyone in the family sign about my mom not fitting in and being unfit. And I always thought that it was just between my mom and dad, and the rest of the family was just keeping quiet about it. But they actually did get pulled in a variety of ways.
Your dad actually packed these boxes for you to have when he was gone. And now he's gone, and you're going through the boxes. What do you want to tell your dad about this gift that he gave you?
I don't think I would say thank you. Unfortunately, it's somewhere in the middle. I'm not grateful, but I'm not resentful either.
Well, Nicole, I want to wish you luck unpacking those boxes.
Thank you, Desiree. It was really a pleasure talking to you.
You'll find a link to Nicole's blog and links to the stories about Kim Hirschberger and John Moe. Spend some time with us at our website, weekendamerica.org. And if you like, send us a letter while you're there. We'll be right back.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
Welcome to The Weekend. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. I have got much cleaning to do this weekend. I have leftover paint in my garage that's not just mine, but I still have paint left from the previous owners of my house.
I feel that pain.
You do?
Yes,
really?
Absolutely.
See, the fact that I can't just dump it down the storm drain, or I know I shouldn't, just lets me keep procrastinating. Americans accumulate millions of gallons of used paint every year. In San Francisco, some immigrants to this country have come up with a solution, and reporter Nancy Mullane now takes us to the Sunset Scavenger Recycling Center.
By 11 a.m., a steady stream of people are pulling up in their cars, vans, and trucks, ready to drop off their old cans of paint.
Hi there.
Good morning. How can I help you today?
I have some empty, well, not empty, but used paint.
Used paint? Okay. Is this paint coming from your house?
Yes.
Okay. Betsy Brown pops open her trunk. Recycling workers reach in and lift out about a half dozen cans.
I'm happy both to get rid of it, and I'm happy to know that somebody who knows what to do with it is taking care of it for me.
Thank you.
10 years ago, all of this latex paint would have been either incinerated or shipped to Los Angeles and used as an additive in sidewalk cement. But one of the workers at the center, an immigrant from El Salvador, had an idea. Why not ship the good leftover paint to his home country, where it could be used to paint schools and hospitals? Another immigrant worker from Mali, Usman C., took up the idea and made it work.
I was born in Africa, raised in Africa, and I know how, you know, poverty is. I know have or have not what that means. And I knew it from day one, I can make a lot of people smile, a lot of people proud.
The company bookkeeper checked the numbers and found it would cost the same to ship the paint to Latin America or Africa as it was costing to ship it to Los Angeles and pay to turn it into cement. So over the past 10 years, the employee-owned company has shipped more than 25,000 gallons of recycled latex paint to towns and villages in countries such as El Salvador, Mexico, and Tonga. Oftentimes, Usman spends his own money and uses his vacation time to go along with the paint. His most recent trip was to his home country of Mali.
You gotta see how that part of Africa has been hit by the HIV/AIDS. A lot of kids in orphanage, a lot. And the NGOs are doing what they can, the United Nations are doing what they can, the country are doing what they can, but they need help. And that's my way, to tell them, we care. And, putting a smile on those faces is priceless.
As the cans pile up, workers begin processing this morning's paint. Standing in an area that looks like a Jackson Pollock painting and wearing head-to-toe blue hazmat suits and face masks, they pry open each can of paint and take a look. Speaking through his mask, Gustavo Munoz says if the paint is clean and has a smooth texture, it can be mixed together and recycled. And so it doesn't all turn into a single blob brownish color. They separate the paints into three color types.
So we have the off-white, and then the cool colors and the warm colors.
When the barrel with cool colors is full, Gustavo attaches a motor to the tip of a big paddle wheel sticking out of the top and mixes the colors together. When 2,000 gallons have been accumulated, Usman makes arrangements to ship the paint by container to countries who need it and request it. Usman says they take whatever colors they have and get creative.
The folks who are getting the paint, they care less about the color. Red, green, white, they can mix them up. It's unbelievable. So, the color, doesn't matter.
This time, 2,300 gallons are being loaded into a steel cargo container headed for Zambia. Usman has a system for stacking the buckets.
We have to follow the pattern because the container is going to be on a ship. And sometimes, the sea is very rough. So we don't want none of those containers to spill. So we have to, load them up tight in a way they're not going to spill.
When the container is full, Usman pulls the large steel doors closed and fixes the wide latch.
I'm just going to close it. Yep, done. Ready to go.
The container full of paint begins its five-week journey from San Francisco to Lusaka, the capital of Zambia. Cindy Threlkeld is there watching and waiting for the paint to arrive.
The delivery will be exciting. It will come first into Lusaka, and then we'll find a way to get it out to the volunteers.
Cindy is country director for the Peace Corps in Zambia. Sitting in her office in Lusaka, she says paint is available in Zambia for people who live in the cities and have money. But Peace Corps volunteers work in remote villages with people who are desperately poor.
This paint is going to be able to allow the volunteers in the communities that they're working with to be able to paint schools and to paint their clinics and to make their villages and their communities look nice and look neat and something that they can be proud of.
Back at the center, workers have already recycled and collected about 100 more buckets of paint. Usman says 5 countries have asked for the next shipment. He's leaning towards sending it to Afghanistan later this summer. In San Francisco, I'm Nancy Mullane for Weekend America.
Want to know what a paint recycling plant looks like? I didn't know. Make a colorful visit to our website, weekendamerica.org.
April showers bring May flowers and lots of beautiful verses. It's National Poetry Month. The nation has been celebrating poets and their works every April since 1996. To mark the first weekend of this year's celebration, folks are at the Silverton Poetry Festival in Oregon. Tonight there's a reading at the Gordon House, which was designed by architect Frank Lloyd Wright. In Albuquerque, New Mexico, it's the Collegiate National Poetry Slam at the El Rey Theater. We thought it would be fitting to bring you a special reading by former U.S. Poet Laureate Mark Strand. Here he reads his poem, Sleeping with One Eye Open.
Unmoved by what the wind does, the windows are not rattled, nor do the various areas of the house make their usual racket, creak at the joints, trusses, and studs. Instead, they are still, and the maples able at times to raise havoc evoke not a sound from their branches' clutches. It's my night to be rattled, saddled with spooks. Even the half moon, half man, half dark, on the horizon, lies on its side, casting a fishy light which alights on my floor, lavishly lording its morbid look over me. Oh, I feel dead, folded away in my blankets for good and forgotten. My room is clammy and cold, moon-handled and weird. The shivers wash over me, shaking my bones. My loose ends loosen, and I lie sleeping with one eye open, hoping that nothing, nothing will happen. I wrote Sleeping with One Eye Open in 1962. I can't remember what I was thinking of. I mean, the poem really is speaks for a certain anxiety I experienced back in the early 60s. I was afraid the United States would go to war with Russia or the USSR. I think it's a poem surrounded by a great deal of silence. Well, I haven't written a poem in 2 years, although I keep writing. I have hundreds of notes and stray sentences, lines, ideas jotted down, but no finished poem. It usually takes me a long time to get anything done. I accumulate pages and pages and pages, and then spend the next, you know, after I have that, maybe a year sorting everything out and connecting one page to another, one line to another line. It's just the way I work. I write longhand, so I'm very slow, terribly slow.
Poet Mark Strand is a former U.S. Poet Laureate. He teaches at Columbia University. Some have said his poetry is dark. He says it's evenly lit.
That's great. And to help you observe National Poetry Month, the American Academy of Poets has a celebration suggestion for every day of April. So this weekend, the Academy proposes that you bring poetry into your spiritual practice.
Yeah, but not all poets are embracing that spiritual vibe of the month. If you go to our website, you can hear a story by reporter Sean Cole about National Poetry Month backlash, including Charles Bernstein's reading of his poem. It's entitled Against National Poetry Month as Such. It's all at weekinamerica.org.
April showers are fluffy and white this weekend in the Upper Plains. Here's John Moe with more about the weekend weather.
Hampton, Arkansas has sun, 71 degrees, and festive hogs. It's the Hogskin Holidays Festival with antique cars, parade, children's tractor pull. Wait, is that children pulling tractors? I'm confused. Plus racing and diving pigs. The pigs are all, hey, this was fun, let's do it again next year. And then it gets kind of awkward because they don't know about the pork barbecue cook-off. Eaten any good books lately? You will if you go to Hayes, Kansas. Clouds and 70 degrees for the International Edible Book Festival. Gastroliterologists, I just made that term up, but I think it works, create books that are exhibited, documented, then eaten. Least appetizing? I'm going with Of Mice and Men. Whether you love international competition or you're a fan of weights gliding slowly across ice, get to Grand Forks, North Dakota. Clouds and 37 for the World Men's Curling Championship. Other groups that might enjoy this, people who like watching pensive Canadians, and broom enthusiasts. So really broad appeal. For information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm John Moe for Weekend America.
Coming up, it was a dark and stormy night, and the rest is up to you. An online open source novel goes ballistic on Weekend America.
Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Online at calvert.com.
You're listening to Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. This weekend, Charlie Bonner is in trouble. He's dealing with a crooked politician, an exotic dancer who knows too much, and his own wife, who is even sneakier than he is. Fortunately, Charlie is a fictitious character in the Los Angeles Times' ongoing online open-source novel, Birds of Paradise. The thing is, every day, readers send in a new chapter. So hundreds of these chapters come in, about 600 words apiece, and every day the judges at the paper choose a winner, and it's published the next day. Times columnist Steve Lopez created this experiment. He wrote the first chapter and released it to the public last weekend. His problem is he also has the responsibility of writing the last chapter. He will have to tie all of this back together, which is going to be like catching confetti because this public novel is spinning out of his control.
Well, what happened was I did chapter one, and in retrospect, maybe I should not have left so many options. And I had, I think, three characters, and I had the main character, a TV producer by the name of Charlie Bonner, who had made his name and his fortune in reality television, on his way mysteriously to the airport to grab a flight to Cabo, where he had an important meeting. And on his way, he's grabbing bundles of cash out of the safe at his house and clearly cooking up something for his wife, Jeannie. And there's a congressman involved in this. Of course, it's kind of a grubby congressman who has gotten into some trouble at a strip club in Hollywood called Jumbo's Clown Room.
The place was perfect, dark and small, and the dancers had just enough tattoos, piercings, and missing body parts to keep it interesting. Best of all, he was nowhere near his district, and that meant no one would notice him. And even if they did, they certainly weren't the type to care.
We've got this congressman, we've got this TV producer. We're not sure what the connection is. We're not sure what's going to happen in Cabo. You know, it looks like somebody is going to off the stripper. Not bad, right?
Good, juicy stuff.
Good, juicy stuff. The problem seems to be that each day people added new major characters, new major plot lines, and rather than clarifying or advancing the story, it just kind of got, you know, very hairy in a hurry.
Bonner was breathing hard when he hit the sidewalk. The familiar sour taste was rising in his throat as he yanked the cell phone from his satchel and dialed Ernesto's number, cursing as his chubby fingers hit the wrong numbers. After this was all over, he thought, diet for sure. And hair plugs. He hit send.
I was on vacation when it started, and when I got back, you know, my editor, Sue Horton, said, why don't I write a note trying to gently push people back on track with this thing? So I tried that a couple days ago. I'm not sure
Please,
that it was successful.
Please, people, can we focus this thing? Can we have someone be a
yes.
hero?
Yeah, or can we at least know what are the motives?
Right.
Who are we rooting for? Who are the good guys? Who are the bad guys?
Yeah, and new characters are coming in. You're reading hundreds of them. So, like, where does our plot begin and end?
See, now you think it's tough for you, and you've only read the winners. When we go to these meetings each day, we've each read through maybe 20 or 25 of these. And you're supposed to pick two or three that you can nominate at this meeting as the possible winner. So as you begin this discussion, you cannot remember whether the stuff in your head is from the already published winners or new plot lines and characters that you've just read through in the 2025 submissions you've judged.
So now you're in a thicket, Steve. What have you learned?
I've learned that we need a real writer to step in, get this back on track.
Take it out of the public's hands.
Carmen downed the remainder of her Pacifico and put the empty bottle down on top of a story about a congressman named Falco. The name was familiar. She wasn't sure why. Suddenly, the apartment door splintered, and a tall blonde man flashing a switchblade burst in, lunging in her direction. What the? She cried. She whirled out of her chair and grabbed the first thing she could find to defend herself with. A clay flower pot.
I will say this. It's been really cool to have hundreds of people, not just entering this thing, but really interested when you call to hear your feedback and your comments and why didn't they win. And it's not writers who are submitting necessarily. There are cops. There are, you know, people from insurance companies. The winner yesterday was a guy from Disney. I asked, okay, are you in the creative end? No, he's in marketing. And it's been a real surprise, the range of people that are involved in this thing.
And what have you learned about them from the kind of stuff, the kind of material they're giving you?
There are a lot of sick people out there who are really enjoying, you know, going noir.
Steve Lopez of the LA Times, thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me. We're counting on your contributions.
Connor paused. Falco was famously wary of keeping his personal and professional lives separate. Their meetings had always taken place at neutral locations. He could hear a low murmuring in the background and Falco's ragged breathing. And then the line went dead. Bonner sighed heavily, weighing his options and his loyalties. Change of plans, he said. We're going to Beverly Hills.
The whole novel so far at weekendamerica.org. Des, you're a fiction writer. Would you want to compose a novella by committee?
I can't even imagine that. But I guess it would help if you have writer's block. That would work.
Yes.
It reminds me of this game called Exquisite Corpse. Have you ever played it?
I haven't.
Well, it's this old parlor game. It was used by the French surrealists in the 1920s. And in the game, you'd write a phrase on a sheet of paper, and then you'd conceal most of what you wrote, pass it on to the next player. They'd add to it, conceal what they wrote, and pass it on. And then you'd end up with this bizarre body of work at the end. One time, I was with this group of women that I belong to, we wrote a novel like this on a bus trip to Chicago. And exactly what Steve Lopez complained about happened. Like, the story whipped around from a friendly meeting between strangers, and then somehow it got preaching about God's love, and then there's these steamy love scenes. It was hilarious to read at the end.
And why is it called Exquisite Corpse?
Well, when the surrealists played the game, they ended up with this phrase, "The exquisite corpse will drink the new wine." Voila.
You spent a rewarding hour with American Public Media's Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. Remember, you can download a free podcast of the entire program at weekendamerica.org. It's the weekend. Enjoy.
News and financial information brought to you by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
Most people enjoy their weekends, relaxing, getting things done. Our new series, Weekend Shift, looks at weekends in a different way.
We like to really just get killed with tickets.
For Chef Ian Pierce, Saturday night is the busiest night of his work week.
We love to just have a ton of people in the restaurant, just pound it out. It's thrilling.
Working to make your weekends possible on the next Weekend America. Join us.